So what he means by the sacred is something very specific, and it has to do with the origin of human culture, and that religion is at the origins.
Hi, everyone. It's Adam Erickson here, and hey, I hope that you're having a great day. It's Thursday today. You might be watching this on Thursday or Friday or whenever you watch these kinds of videos. I hope that you're having a fantastic day. It is raining and stormy and windy here in Portland, Oregon, which is fine because it tends to be that way here in Portland. So it's good. I am just waiting now for my colleague and the co-founder here at the Raven Foundation, Suzanne Ross, to come on, because we are going to be talking about this amazing book. There's Suzanne. I'm just going to bring her on right now. Let's see if we can do this. Bring Suzanne on the camera. There we go. So we're going to talk about this amazing book by Renee Girard called...
Hey!
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I was just introducing people to our topic of the day, and I said we're going to be talking about this amazing book by Renee Girard called Hi, Suzanne. It's not called Hi, Suzanne. It is actually called Violence and the Sacred. There you go. If you can read backwards, that's awesome. And if you can read this book, that's even better, because this book, when I first read it, got chewed up by my dog. I had a puppy at the time, and puppies chew things, didn't you know? So chewed the cover of my book right there, Violence and the Sacred.
Well,
kind of appropriate,
wouldn't
you think? Violence and the Sacred, the dog attacking such a book with such a title?
Well, I like to say he devoured it, just like we did.
Yeah! This is one of the important things. What is violence? Is this attacking a book or is it devouring a book? Nicely done, Susan.
Oh my gosh. Nice interpretation. That's very good.
What exactly is it is violence that we're talking about? That's one of the things we're going to discuss in our chat, possibly. We'll see.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, Renee begins the book by asking that question in a just a slightly different way. It's like, why do we avoid talking about violence in a context in which violence is front and center, which is the violent sacrifices of the ancient world?
Yeah.
And he was sort of taking on the sort of anthropologists and social theorists and history of religion people of the day, of saying, you know, there's something really obvious here that you're not addressing. And that is the role of violence in the sacrificial world.
That's a really interesting point, a really good point. But I just want to bring up, as you say, he takes on anthropologists. And here he is, trained as a literary critic, right? Doing anthropology, doing myth interpretation. This is one of the reasons that Girard gets in a little bit of trouble, because he dabbles all over the place in these different disciplines. And you're supposed to, in the academic world, stick with your own discipline. And so he gets into a lot of trouble, and people often don't take him seriously because he's trained as a literary critic going into anthropology and theology and all of these different academic disciplines.
Exactly. But I think it's part of what made him able to see things more clearly, in that he was coming to these disciplines sort of from the outside. He wasn't steeped in the "this is how we've always done it" way of approaching things. And he actually started out as a historian. So he was clearly, you know, trained in how to do research and to understand and read texts and so forth. So he's just one of those incredible intellects who was able to conquer a number of disciplines, but then see this big, see the way they're connected, to see patterns. And apparently I understand that's what makes someone smart. It's not how much you can remember, but how well you see connections between the things that you're studying. Wow, this man was a genius at connections.
Yes. Well,
Sam Sorich is watching.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Hi, Sam. Mm-hmm. That just did not look really good, putting my thumb or my hand over the camera.
Yeah, me going like this. Yeah.
No, your waving was awesome. Me going like this, that was not good. Me going, that's okay.
Yeah.
Aaron O'Neill is on. Sam is on. We've got some other people on too. I had this problem with my computer and my Wi-Fi this morning. So the way that I usually bring in questions and comments, I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to do that, but I'm going to try. So if you are watching and you have questions or comments about violence in the sacred or anything else related to mimetic theory, go ahead and try to leave those in the comment section, and I will do my best to bring you in. But I am behind the eight ball a little bit.
I'm thinking about Sam this morning because he's a filmmaker, and he's doing this really cool video project about the Beatitudes. And Sam, just kind of type in where, I know there's a website and there's the right title for your project and everything, but just type it in and we'll shout it out, because it's really a brilliant, brilliant idea. And he's a brilliant filmmaker. So it should be a good project.
That would be awesome. And Sam, that would be a good way for me to test to see if I can see comments. Because I'm hitting all kinds of buttons down here and it's not making sense. There I go again. So anyway, hey, let's try to make some connections. Are you seeing any comments, Suzanne?
Yes. It's the numeral 8 beats, BEATS, as in like short for Beatitudes, 8beatsmovie.com.
Awesome. Well, I am not able to see the comments. So Suzanne, I will rely on you, if that's okay, to try to bring in comments.
I might not see all of them, but you know, I might just see people that I'm friends with, but I'm friends with everybody, so I should.
You are so popular.
I am just,
so envious of you right now and your popularity. I am so mimetic. So let's get into this conversation about violence in the sacred.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, let's do that. You were talking about all the connections that Gerard is able to see in these patterns. And I thought that maybe a good way, here's one of the things that I wanted to say about violence in the sacred right away. Oftentimes people will post on Facebook channels, hey, what book do you recommend for people who are interested in René Girard to read? To get like, you know, an introductory to him. I would never recommend Violence in the Sacred as a way to get an introductory book to René Girard's thought. Much better would be Evolution and Conversion or Satan Fall Like Lightning. One of those books I think would be much better, because this book is tough. It's a difficult book to read. He does so much in it. And it's difficult to process. The first time I read it, I took a bunch of notes, and at the end of every chapter, I tried to summarize what Gerard was saying. And each one starts off, I think he's saying this. There's just a lot going on there. So, but at the same time, when the book came out in 1972, the French journal Le Monde said that it was a watershed year, because this was the first atheistic theory of religion and the sacred. This goes to show you how difficult this book is to understand, because René Girard is not an atheist. He's nowhere close to being an atheist. And yet you can pick up this book and you can be left with that kind of impression. Now, 1972 was, I think, a watershed year because of this book. It's an important book. But to say it's an atheistic book, it was to miss the point.
Yeah, it was. I think the point is that Rene was trying to put forward a truly scientific theory of the origins of religion. That doesn't mean it's an atheistic theory, but it's scientific. And Rene always insisted that his work was scientific, but he also said that his Christian faith was part of his work as well. And so people who want to divide science and religion into opposing camps have a really hard time with Girard. But people who do study religion and study history and who are people of faith and who are also scientists don't have any problem understanding how those two don't oppose one another. But that's a subject for another video, and we could bring in Grant Kaplan to talk about that.
We have already brought in Grant Kaplan to talk about that, so we can post
that.
Yes,
actually,
up.
We have. Yeah.
So there are a couple of ways that we could start off the conversation. I thought that what we should do, what might be a good way to do it, is just to talk about the title of the book, Violence and the Sacred. You said that Girard makes these great connections and sees these patterns, and I think the title tips us off right away to a pattern that he is seeing in ancient religion. And so one of the things that could lead you to think this was an atheistic theory is that it almost looks like Girard is critiquing religion qua religion as violent.
Yeah.
So one of the questions would be, what does Girard mean by the sacred? Because in the typical view of the sacred, we usually think of it as a good thing, as reaching out to God. But what Rene Girard is doing in this book is bringing us towards a more anthropological view of the sacred.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really important to define terms, as you say. What does he mean by sacred? What does he mean by religion? And Keith is asking this question about Rene's conversion. I mean, Rene was, I think, raised in a nominally Catholic family in France. But when he was writing his first book, and it was about novelists, Deceit, Desire, and the Novel, he had a little health scare, and he renewed his commitment to Catholicism. That was in the 60s, I think. It was before Violence and the Sacred, although I think he had already started writing Violence and the Sacred while he was writing Deceit, Desire, and the Novel. Anyway, so what he means by the sacred is something very specific, and it has to do with the origin of human culture, and that religion is at the origins. There's no human culture that doesn't have religion or some practice of religion. And for him, that means the ancient rituals, myths, and prohibitions that were all around the way society was organized. So societies were all organized around a sacrificial relationship to the gods. And again, by sacrifice, he means literally sacrificing, shedding blood on an altar in order to appease the gods and establish and maintain harmony in the community. Most of us look back on that and think, well, they were delusional. What made them think that killing a goat or a sheep or even an unblemished, perfect lamb was going to appease like a god? And why would gods demand that sacrifice and that kind of sacrifice? And what Girard realized was that it seems irrational to us, but the origins of these supposedly bizarre practices are in is something that actually happened and happened repeatedly within these proto-human communities. And so they may have extrapolated it in an odd way so that it looks odd to us, but the reality of the origins of the practice is what he was getting at and uncovering.
Yes, and the reality was that these sacrifices worked, right? Not so much to appease an angry god, but to appease the wrath that was in the community, right?
Yeah.
So a couple of months ago, we did a book study that people can watch on YouTube and our Raven channel on Deceit, Desire in the Novel, right? And Deceit, Desire in the Novel is where Girard puts forth really the mimetic desire and how we fall into conflict when we're going after the same things. And this, from Deceit, Desire in the Novel, he goes to violence in the sacred and postulates that it's really not our differences, right, that lead us into conflict as we all just kind of assume. This is one of the things that's hard to get about Girard's theory. It's our similarities, our similar desires for things that lead us into conflict. And so he postulates that at the very beginning, humans are highly mimetic. And so we're in these conflicts with one another. And all of those conflicts, he writes in Violence in the Sacred, caused some early communities to implode. So in a war of all against all, right? But what happens in the sacred moment is when all of that hostility and the violence get channeled against a scapegoat who is sacrificed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a temporary sense of peace after this sacrifice happens. The scapegoat is the one who's demonized by the whole community. And then Girard makes this really interesting flip that's also really hard for us to understand, that while the scapegoat was demonized during his life, right, all of a sudden there's now a sense of peace. And there's this switch that happens that now this one who brought all this chaos and violence to us has now brought us a sense of peace. And out of the sense of peace, the scapegoat gets divinized. And so this Girard states is where you find the creation of the gods.
Right. And there's so much in there, because a lot of people, as you say, misunderstand that he's making some sort of moral statement about what's going on. And it especially becomes complicated because when we use the word scapegoat, it has a moral valence for us. So yeah. We know a scapegoat is innocent, and that when you harm or kill a scapegoat, that you're guilty and you've done something wrong. But the term scapegoat is a little misleading, right, in this origin scene that of this highly, you know, what makes us human is our increasing mimeticism. And that our desires are no longer tied to our instincts, but becoming free in order that we can become more innovative, or that's what the outcome was. We were more creative and innovative and weren't tied to doing the same thing over and over again, like instincts tie you to repeated behaviors. But this higher mimeticism made us really prone to our desires becoming converging and all of us coming into conflict. And you know, it's interesting because the victim that gets sacrificed is very randomly chosen, arbitrarily chosen. I think Renee's careful not to say it's random because it is a mechanism, but it ends up being an arbitrarily chosen target for all. So the whole community is in this turmoil of conflict. A whole bunch of little conflicts are going on all over the place, and everybody is, irritated and anxious, and, you know, think about how we feel, you know, during economic crisis, people are losing their jobs, everybody's kicking their dog and honking their horns, and, you know, it's just the community is unsettled. And but because we're mimetic, it's easy for all of this anxiety and anxiousness to get directed and converge all on one target. And that's what happens. That's what happens spontaneously, right? And as you well said, Adam, this the one that it all gets converged on is blamed for everything. And so we get rid of this guy and this person, and boom, problem will be solved. And lo and behold, the problems are solved. Everybody is unified around the corpse. And suddenly the corpse that looked like the cause of the conflict is now the creator of the peace, and is in that moment where this is what he means by the sacred. It's that place where the peace happens because of violence. So that's why these sacrifices are repetitions, a ritualized repetition of something that had worked, right, to bring the community to peace. And they ritualize it in hopes of preventing the complete breakdown of the culture again. And that's, you know, we have a quote here from Renee. I'll just I'll read that about his definition of sacred. He said, the sacred consists of all those forces whose dominance over man increases or seems to increase in proportion to man's efforts to master them. Violence, the greatest of those forces that we try to master, but that masters us. Violence is the heart and secret soul of the sacred. That's like the takeaway one liner from the book that gets repeated, yes, at every conference and at least 12 times and so in papers. I see a comment from Guillermo Rivera. Is there any comment or study on how much time would have to pass for these patterns that protect societies from implosion to become cultural stories or myths? This is all lost in prehistory, of course. And Renee speculated that it was, you know, probably thousands of years and in multiple places around the globe where these patterns of conflict, mimetic conflicts, would just naturally have arisen before we stumbled on this solution, which is the sacrificial solution, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, over thousands of years. That's the way that Gerard answers it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk more about that quote that you brought up, that violence is at the heart of the sacred, right?
Right.
And this again is where I think that Gerard is prone to a misunderstanding from maybe a superficial reading, where mm-hmm. Where Gerard is saying that that religion it's the role of religion and violence, right? Mm-hmm. Where a lot of atheists today will say, see, the Bible is violent, and God is violent, and so this is where one could use Gerard going in that direction. But he's talking about an archaic view of religion, and this is where I think the anthropology of it is so important,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he's not in this book getting to Jesus or the Hebrew scriptures. He's just talking about what he would call archaic religion.
Yeah, it's very much analyzing the myths and rituals in the pre-Christian, pre-Judeo-Christian axial revolution world, you know.
Yeah.
Very much so. Because he says religion, so he gives this very broad definition of religion, which can encompass the ancient and the revelatory religions and modern religions. And he says it's in the broadest sense, it's an attempt for humans to control violence. And he says it's the term for the obscurity around those efforts, in which we deflect the responsibility for our own violence onto something else, and where we also obscure the sacrificial solution, which is that we're using violence to control violence. Mm-hmm. So, but when we're doing it, we're casting ourselves as good, as religious, as devoted people, right?
This is the point that he makes over and over again about the distinction in religious terms between good violence and bad violence.
Right.
And this is where we often can get stuck in Girard possibly making a moral claim about violence, but that's not what he's doing here. He's not making a moral claim. All he's saying is that good violence is that which gets good violence in quotes is that which gets channeled against a scapegoat and controls bad violence, which is the chaotic violence that's all around us.
Yeah, right. The good violence is violence that's sanctioned, that's approved, that's the religiously approved violence, which is the violence of, in the ancient world, the priests and at the altar and the political forces aligned with the, you know, religious forces, of course, and any violence that escapes those containers, that re-enters the community, is bad, right? And so we can see it today. I like to give the example of just, you know, a football game. American football game. It works for soccer as well, but American football game, it's okay for people to crash into each other, knock each other down, break bones, do anything they want to do within the rules of the game. But if you punch someone after the whistle blows, that's bad. That's the bad violence. So the good violence is happening within the rules, the ritual of the game. Anything outside of that, even if it's the exact same thing, the exact same action, is now punished. It's bad. It's bad violence. So that's basically what Girard means by these terms, good and bad violence. It's just sanctioned versus unsanctioned. And truly, the bad violence does have the bad effect of unleashing violence, and it becomes quite contagious. So, you know, one punch of a referee, the benches could empty, the fans could come out onto the field, and everything deteriorates. It's total chaos. So that is truly the bad violence, because it's escaped the ritual controls. And that's, no one wants chaos. Well, some people do. So I won't say no one, and some of them I know personally.
Right.
But yeah, chaos is not good for the health of the community.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Girard always warns against, is that you want violence to be contained, which is what religion does by channeling it against a scapegoat. But you can't contain violence. It always overflows, as you say, it overflows its container, right? And this is one of the ways, one of the terms that he uses, this leads to a sacrificial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
When you can't contain the violence, and it's also, I think, when it leads to a sacrificial crisis is when everybody, you can no longer agree on a scapegoat, on one scapegoat, right? And so everybody is pointing the fingers at everybody else, and violence just runs amok. It goes over its containers. And this is one of the issues that happened in the early human communities, sacrificial crisis, and they imploded. And it's also one of the issues, to bring it to a modern example, that we are coming into today, sacrificial crisis, right? Where people, you see this in politics all the time, where politics tends to be about when it gets away from the common good, politics gets towards finding somebody else to blame so that I'm not the one who gets blamed, right? So everybody's fingers at everybody else. North Korea, Russia, we point the finger at Republicans, point finger at Democrats, Donald Trump, nobody is falling for the same scapegoat anymore.
No, it is hard to get unity nowadays. It's and certainly, you know, one of the terms that Renee uses in this book, of course, is that a sacrificial crisis is a crisis of difference. And what he means by that is that, you know, go back to that originary scene where the community is all at each other's throats and everyone's kicking their neighbor and no one's plowing the fields anymore. Everyone's angry. That aggression gets channeled against one target. And because it brings peace, suddenly that aggression turns good because it achieves something good for the community, right? So the difference that the sacrificial world establishes, that difference between what's allowed violence, what's sanctioned, what's good violence, and what's bad. And when that breaks down, like a football field example, you have a crisis of difference. Not only that there's no good violence anymore, it's just all violence, but everyone becomes the same. They become mirror images of each other. So everyone's angry and throwing punches now in this big melee. There's no, even the referees will get caught up in throwing punches. Because violence is so contagious, not to mention it hurts. So you're going to want to defend yourself and, you know, and then if you hit my friend, I'm going to hit your friend. Then you get cycles of revenge. And unless you can contain it again, unless, you know, somehow bring it back under control with an application of good sanctioned violence, that crisis of difference will destroy the community. And just to reiterate, this is not a moral judgment. This is just a anthropological observation of how violence can take over a community and how it can be used to reestablish order.
He has, so that's the way that we did it in the ancient world. A lot of people also think that Girard is against institutions because he'll say that institutions formed out of archaic sacrifice, so they're sacrificial. And in a sense, that's true. But he has this really interesting move that he makes right at the beginning of the book about modern judicial systems, right? The modern institutional system. And this, I think, is a way that Girard is saying that sometimes these modern institutions are actually good. they can have problems, and we can point to problems in our judiciary system all over the place. But in a sense, he's saying that this is a step forward in the process of being human, because before the kingdom of God comes, I think he even says this in Violence in the Sacred, before the kingdom of God comes, we need a higher institution, a higher authority to be able to channel violence in certain places. Is that right? Is that what he's saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think he's contrasting the way the sacrificial system worked, which is the way the judicial system works. And so what he's saying in the sacrificial system, it works because that the victim that's chosen is a substitute victim. Like, you know, the goat didn't offend anybody, but there's a whole bunch of people in the community who are offended by one another. And if violence breaks out, you know, so we have to go back and recall that solidarity within communities obligates you to vengeance. So if you're in a committed kinship relationship or community relationship, and someone in your community, let's say, gets murdered, you're obligated to go out and get the son of a you-know-what that killed your kin, right? And so then you go kill their someone in another community, then they're obligated to come back and avenge the death of their kin. And so what can happen in these, and this is where Paul Dumachel is brilliant. What's the name of his book? It'll come to me. The Barren Sacrifice. Where he analyzes this, but you can get into these traps of cycles of vengeance. And so sacrifice works because the victim that's sacrificed is not going to stimulate a return act of vengeance. So all of the aggression can be targeted in this sort of festival ritual activity. But it ends the cycle by deflecting.
Gerard talks about like the marks of the scapegoat. And one of those marks is that they don't have a defender. They don't have somebody to come back and seek vengeance in return, right? So guilt and innocence don't matter. One of the things that matters is that this is a weaker person, somebody who doesn't have a defender. And one of the things that makes the modern judiciary system different is at least an attempt to find the person who's truly guilty.
Well, exactly. So I suppose if you want to think that's better, morally better, I don't know if it's morally better or not. By contrast, because sacrifice works by deflecting onto a substitute victim all the aggression, in our world with our legal systems, we have invested the judiciary with enough authority that they can dispense an act of vengeance on the correct person. We are assuming we found the correct guilty party, and dispense the vengeance with so much finality that there's no retaliation. Okay.
And so,
I'm just saying both systems are trying to end the retaliation, end the cycle of revenge. And they just do it by a different, slightly different focus. One shifts onto a substitute.
And the judiciary, the modern judiciary system is prone to sacrificial crises when it doesn't do its job effectively, or when it, as you say, like it doesn't, the containers of violence don't hold it in, or when it misses the mark on the person who's truly guilty or,
the judiciary relies on being impartial.
Yeah.
Right. So that both sides do not have any cause to think they haven't been properly represented. And so impartiality is essential. And part of why our legal system goes so slowly, it is in direct contrast to a mob or a spontaneous act of vengeance, which goes really fast and no one has a chance to defend themselves. I mean, you still see it nowadays. Unfortunately, spontaneous violence breaks out all the time and innocent people get killed before they can say, excuse me, I was just walking by, and I didn't, you know, it. And so the judicial system is slow on purpose to ensure that everyone is heard, that impartiality is, at least the illusion of impartiality is preserved, and that when the judgment comes down, it's seen as final.
Right.
You can appeal it, then there's ways to go to appeals, but you don't take up arms and mm-hmm. and take the law into your own hands. See? The vengeance now is in the hands of the legal system, not in yours.
Yes, and when we have people going after judges in the judicial system, we're calling for a sacrificial crisis. It's very dangerous.
Yeah,
to critique that. Although, go ahead.
Not to name names, but it is very dangerous
right.
for someone in the executive branch to be calling into question the impartiality of the judiciary is calling for indeed this crisis of difference where now where's the so-called good judgment in, if you want to say instead of vengeance, where's the good judgment happening? Mm. If you can't trust that it's happening, then you're going to have to do it yourself.
Right. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
how it works.
Yes. So we are coming to the end of our time. And so thank you, Suzanne, for this conversation. And thank you, everybody, for watching. This is our first in our series on violence and the sacred. And I think how we're going to handle this conversation in our next couple of conversations on violence and the sacred is to talk about, do shorter videos talking about specific terms with Girardian scholars, so more academics. So we're going to talk with certain people about what does Girard mean by myth? What does Girard mean by sacrificial crisis? What are some other terms that, what does he mean? Well, what does he mean by mimetic? What does he mean by mimetic violence? What is violence according to Girard? So we're gonna invite some more academics to come on and talk with us about those terms. And so keep up to date on those conversations on the Raven Foundation Facebook page and the Raven Review website.
And also there's a big section in Violence and the Sacred on Freud and the founding murder and the Oedipal triangle, which we'll get into, I think, with, I have someone in mind for that. So
good.
I won't name that we've invited this person to join us, but yes. Yeah, there's some really good, interesting material in there that we'll have some fun conversations.
Yeah. Twins. What is Girard going with the whole twins thing and mimetic doubles and stuff? So those are also really cool things.
And monsters.
So monsters. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Awesome. So thank you everybody for watching. Stay up to date on the Raven Foundation Facebook page. Until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.